It was entertainment with bigger-than-life personalities going toe-to-toe, match after match. Good guys and bad guys exhibiting both their athletic prowess and their skill as performers. It still goes on around the country, and this week, Charlotte is home to it once again as we host the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest through Sunday at the Hilton University Place. Now, we're going to use that opportunity to bring you the greatest body slam of them all, the ultimate smackdown, when NPR listeners meet pro wrestlers this hour. We're going to meet several, in fact, but we're going to begin with someone who was a fixture on the Charlotte wrestling scene in the 70s and 80s, a good guy in the ring, and a really good guy out of the ring. I know that because for a while he put up with me as my personal trainer. Not that I got anything out of it, mind you, because I'm just a wuss, but he was terrific at it. Former professional wrestler and World Wrestling Entertainment Ambassador Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Good to talk to you again, Ricky. Nice to have you with us.
It's good to talk to you again, Mike. What an intro. God, I'd like to use you in all of my introductions.
Well, great. Feel free. Before we talk about you and your career and your legendary rivalry against Ric Flair, let's just talk about wrestling. At its height, and it's still popular today, but today it's gone from being in arenas, that people traveling from small arenas to big arenas to television mostly. But at its height, what made it so popular? Because it was the topic of conversation.
Well, Mike, as you know, when in the 70s and 80s when I was wrestling, and that's when you and I had met, we were in small arenas. We were pretty much throughout the country, there was promotion done through what they would call territories, and production level on the television side was maybe a 3-4 at its best. Small studios, maybe 50 fans, and it would be a Saturday morning time slot. And when in the mid-80s, when WrestleMania, with the promoter Vince McMahon at the helm, decided to go coast-to-coast with his television and then bring it to major venues around the country, in which, you know, seating capacity was 15, 20,000. As opposed to studios with 50, the production level, of course, jumped, and it brought wrestling into bigger than life, movie stardom quality, in which then all of us were almost like thought of as big time movie stars.
You were like rock stars. I mean, you would rock the rafters of these places, and people talked about it in normal conversation, even casual people who didn't really watch the matches every time they were on. They would just maybe pass them as they were channel surfing, would stick around and watch it and be able to talk about it at the water cooler. People have forgotten that. But this all happened for you before it happened that way. I mean, you got into this before it became really big on television and were there for its ascendancy. So what made you want to do this?
Well, you know, I started in 1974. I went through Vern Gagne's wrestling camp up in Minnesota. He was the AWA, the American Wrestling Alliance promoter. And then there was the NWA. And then during that time, it was the WWF, which is now the WWE. And then I had been wrestling in the Carolinas for about 8 straight years, which was almost unheard of, because a lot of the wrestlers would go to, let's say, Florida or the Georgia territories and then Carolinas, and they would be, you know, a couple years and then move on. And for me to be in the Carolinas for 8 straight years as the good guy or babyface was almost certainly unheard of. Ric Flair being in the same territory as our bad guy heel was for the long run. The two of us hooked up many times in the Carolinas, but I had felt that after being there for 8 years that it was time for a move. And that's when a good friend of mine by the name of George Scott, who had been working in the Carolina office for Jimmy Crockett, you know, Crockett Promotions, mm-hmm. had also ventured to Vince McMahon up in Connecticut, and he gave me a ring. And he did me well in the Carolinas, and he said, well, we really are going to go big here with the company. We're going to go coast to coast with television. We're going to have pay-per-views that are going to be at that time on a national level, which now is on a global level. So I just felt after being in the Carolinas for all that time that it was time for a move and to seek this new adventure and see what this big hype about WrestleMania and the WWE company at that time, was all about.
Yeah. Yeah, as I understand this, and I've always known you as Ricky Steamboat, and I knew that the steamboat part of it was probably not real, but I did not know that your name is actually Dick Blood. You're from Hawaii, and you walked in, I understand, to a promoter's office as Dick Blood and came out as Ricky Steamboat, matinee idol. How did that happen?
Well, I will tell you. I'll tell you how the billing from Hawaii also came about. In 1976, I walked into Tampa, Florida. Eddie Graham, who was promoting that territory of Florida, I came walking in the office. He looked at me, and he said, you know, Dick Blood is a great wrestling name, but it's more for our bad guys, with the last name being Blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a young kid, and he said, I had a guy here in the Florida area that did well for me. His name was Sammy Steamboat. He was from Hawaii. And if you don't mind, he said, I'd like to change you as Ricky Steamboat. We will not bill you as his son, but I will start advertising you as his nephew. So that was like on a Tuesday. On Wednesday, I was in West Palm Beach on the first match on the card, being very green. And they made the introduction and say, ladies and gentlemen, we have a substitution this evening for the opening bout. Unable to make it this evening because of travel, Dick Blood is being substituted, and give it up for the nephew of Sam Steamboat, Ricky Steamboat. And the crowd jumped out of their seats. That's the response I got. Now, prior to that, Mike, I was getting just a handful of claps because Dick Blood was a nobody. And all of a sudden, I looked around the ring, and I saw these people standing up and cheering for me. And I said, oh, man, so this is what it's like when they know you. The ring announcer put the mic behind his back, walked by me. I'm standing in the corner with my jaw dropped. And he goes, smile and wave at the fans, kids. Smile and wave at the fans. So I started smiling and waving. And a month later, Eddie Graham pulled me back into the office. He said, this is what I'm going to do. You've had such a great response with Ricky Steamboat. And I said, well, not because of Ricky Steamboat, but because of, you know, Sam doing all the legwork in the state of Florida, and Sam being a main event, and Sam also being tag team partner to Eddie Graham, in which they were the Florida tag team champions.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie came up with the idea, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do like a second generation. I'm going to team you up with my son, Mike Graham, and it'd be Graham and Steamboat all over again. And you're going to go up against the Hollywood Blondes, who are the current Florida tag team champions, with Humperdinck as their manager. And so then I was introduced to main event, tag team championship, all within a month, and only because of Sam Steamboat.
So that was Ricky Steamboat. When did the Dragon get added to your name? Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. When did that happen?
In the mid-80s when I had ventured up to the WWE, and I was sitting in Vince McMahon's office. Pat Patterson, who's been a long-time, old-time wrestler, was there. And Vince would always like to add a flair to your existing name or give you a new name that you're coming into his company.
Mm-hmm.
And he still liked Ricky Steamboat. It had a good ring to it. And at that time, Bruce Lee and the movies of Return of the Dragon, and I had a Bruce Lee look. I used some martial arts in the ring when I was in my work. So that discussion came up, and then we started throwing around the Dragon.
Yeah.
And he said, God, you could put it Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. You could put Ricky Steamboat the Dragon, or you could put the Dragon Ricky Steamboat. I mean, wherever you put it, it sounded good. So through a roundtable discussion, all of a sudden, the Dragon was added to Ricky Steamboat.
And you've said this a couple of times, and since we're just starting this conversation about wrestling, it probably needs to be said for those who have not followed it, that there are good guys and bad guys, faces and heels, and faces short for baby face, and you kind of had a baby face. So that made you a good guy from the get-go. I mean, did you really have a choice? You kind of had to be a good guy because you looked like a good guy. Is that right?
That is true, but, you know, Mike, don't get me wrong. Almost everybody in the business at one point in time of their career had wrestled as a good guy or bad guy.
Huh.
And a lot of this would be determined on, let's say if you started off with a good guy and you were main event and selling tickets, doing well. But then after a year or two, you sort of wore out your welcome, so to speak, and your sales were dropping off on selling tickets as the main event guy. And then the promoter would say, okay, we're going to switch you heel, bad guy. And all of a sudden, your stock would jump back up because all the fans who were hooraying you could not believe what you're doing in the ring to this other good guy, which would then turn your bad guy heel. Yeah. And they started booing you. And this would raise your stock value back up, keep your main event status. And then, you know, you're off and running again for another year or two.
And you could switch back to being a good guy, and that made you even higher. That made you even more popular.
Well, how many times did Ric Flair switch back to
that? Yeah.
But, you know, honestly with me, throughout my whole career, Mike, I wrestled as a face and never had to switch. Sort of tells you that my stock value as in my position with whatever company I was with was still, you know, going strong.
So you really never got to be a bad guy. You were always a good guy, always a face. Did you ever want to be a bad guy?
Yeah, believe it or not, Mike, the heels in the business, they were the ones having the most fun in the ring because they could really razz the fans and get them upset, and they would, you know, giggle about it and have a lot of fun with it. And there comes a point in time in your career after wrestling so many years, and at this time I've been wrestling for about 17 years, that I just wanted to be able to experience it. You know, it'd be something new. It'd be, rejuvenating. Mm-hmm. And I went to the promotion with Vince McMahon and had said, you know, I'd like to turn heel. And he looked at me and said, it will never happen, Ricky. You are the consummate babyface. He said, I could give you an example, and that is I could send you out to the ring with a chainsaw. And we could have a main event babyface in the ring, and you could jump him, beat him up, take that chainsaw and cut off his arm. And everybody in the place would stand up and say, that guy deserved it. You are such a consummate babyface. If you were to ever turn heel, it would probably ruin your career.
Wow. Now, Ric Flair, with whom you had some classic battles over 17 years, says that one of his greatest blessings was the day that you walked into Jimmy Crockett's office here in Charlotte, because you had everything, charisma, work rate, intensity. In another profession, you might not hear words like that from a rival. So what would you say about Ric Flair?
Well, back at him, he was very flamboyant. He knew his character. He had a great work rate. Plus, he knew what to do in the ring, when to do it, at what time. He had been in the business a couple years prior to me, and when we hooked up, he taught me so much. And fortunately, I could get it. You know, I could grasp things at the moment on the fly. And him being the master in the ring, I learned so much from him on what to do, when to do it. And we sort of just gelled. We blended. Him with the blonde hair, me with the black. Good guy, bad guy.
That's Ricky Steamboat. We'll have more with him in a moment. We'll also talk to longtime professional wrestling manager, promoter, and booker Jim Cornette, and former professional wrestler and booker Kevin Sullivan. The Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest is today through Sunday, by the way, at the Hilton University Place. And we are coming right back with more, another SmackDown segment on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting James Taylor Sunday at PNC Music Pavilion Charlotte, formerly Verizon Wireless Amphitheater. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. We talk a lot about summer movies. We've certainly done that this year. And now let's zero in on summer reading. Summer vacations, that's a time when a lot of people catch up on their reading or just read some trashy romance novels at the beach, whatever. We're going to take a look at some of those, some of the gems that might be awaiting you, and hear about a lot of significant changes in the book publishing industry that affect both writers and readers. It's an encore presentation of a conversation we had back in June, which was really interesting, and you want to get some books you may want to read out of this conversation, so join us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, since March, the Ebola virus has killed nearly 700 people in 4 African countries, the worst outbreak in history. Understanding the nature of the virus and the fight to stop its spread.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest runs today through Sunday at the University Hilton. Tomorrow, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat returns to Charlotte to be part of this. Before the break, you talked, Ricky, about how Ric Flair helped you and kind of mentored you, and yet in the ring, you were mortal enemies. He was the bad guy, you were the good guy, and you've also said in your matches with Ric Flair that we pushed each other to extreme limits. We were out there hanging and banging for 40, 50 minutes every night. Who could blow up who? We did it without anything being said. It was just an ongoing thing where I'd look across the ring at Ric, and he would look across the ring at me, and here we go, and we would just push and push and push. Now, a lot of people have said, and it's obvious that the personas are not necessarily real, that they're put on for entertainment purposes, but a lot of people have said that wrestling is fake, and wrestlers say it's not fake. But is it predetermined? Did you know the outcome before you set foot in the ring?
You know, in the matches, it would all be determined by the promoter, the owner of the company. But many times, not many, but several times, in the course of a match, in the feel of the crowd, the two combatants involved, that there has been finishes changed to which, and it would be done on the fly. Of course, there would be some recourse from the owner. It's only happened to me on a couple of occasions to which the end was changed.
So it's not unlike improvisational theater, where you know the basic structure and you know what's supposed to happen, but if it doesn't happen because it doesn't make sense for it to happen, then you go with the flow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And a lot, you know, the fans would dictate it, and you would get rewarded, and your reward would be that when you'd have your return, the crowd would either be just as big, or even if not more.
Yeah, but you can't fake a body slam. You can't fake having a chair broken over your head. You can't fake being thrown down on the mat and have some big guy who weighs 350 pounds jump on you. You can't fake that. So what does that do? What kind of condition do you have to be in to survive that every night after night after night? And what does it do to you as an individual, to your body over time?
It does take a toll on all your joints, you know, your lower back, your hips, your shoulders. I would, as you knew me, I would always stay in shape.
Oh, yeah.
And condition. I would be doing cardio throughout the day and also weight training. And now, I don't know if you knew, but about 3 years ago, I was doing a thing in the ring with Monday Night Raw, to which they were introducing a 3-disc DVD of my career. And we had some guys that we were getting some heat on, into which I was picked up and thrown down and ended up with a subarachnoid hemorrhage. In other words, I had a brain bleed from the G-forces being thrown down and my head bouncing off the mat maybe one too many times. And I was 57 years old at the time. So my neurosurgeon told me there was just over the years and so many blows and G-forces, slams, suplexes, head into the post, head into the apron, chairs, steel chairs, that the left side of my brain tried to separate from the right side. And in doing so, the blood vessels connecting down inside my brain sheared apart. And I ended up in the Tampa General Hospital in intensive care for 3 weeks. And I went from 228 pounds to down to 199. And the fatality rate, from what I was told, was near 60%. And since the bleed was down inside my brain, they couldn't do anything to it. It either had to fix itself or I was going to pass. And fortunately, it fixed itself. So there are, you know, severe repercussions that can happen to what we do.
Wow. You were always the good guy. People loved you. And I got to say, and I said this before, out of the ring, you were a genuinely good human being. You can't fake that, I don't think. And one of the things that made you so popular is that you hung around with the fans, you'd talk to them, you'd shake their hand, you'd sign their autographs or requests for them. And that's one of the things that you'll be doing at the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest when you get here tomorrow.
There's one thing that I've always recognized, and that is without the fans, we would not have wrestling. As in, you know, many sports or rock concerts or for whatever. They are the ones that are spending the money buying the tickets. So I feel maybe an obligation, commitment, and also a big thank you to all the fans that came out to see me, to take a moment, and if it was to make their day, you know, take a picture, sign an autograph, because they're the ones that bought the ticket, and then down the road paid for my salary and gave me everything that I have now.
That's four-time U.S. heavyweight champion, world TV champion, two-time Mid-Atlantic champion, world wrestling entertainment ambassador, and my trainer, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Ricky will be signing autographs and taking pictures with fans tomorrow from 10 to 5 at the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest. It begins today and runs through Sunday at University Place. And in fact, today, from noon to 5, it's free. Now, we're going to continue to talk about the sport, past and present, with two more folks who know it really well. Jim Cornette's a professional wrestling manager, promoter, booker, commentator, author, and photographer. He managed one of the all-time great tag teams, the Midnight Express, among others, and has been called the most obnoxious manager in wrestling history. What a great way to open. The manager with the tennis racket, the Louisville Slugger, Jim Cornette. Welcome to the program.
Mike, thank you very much. You read that just like I wrote it. I appreciate that, and your check will be in the mail.
Thank you.
I had to have more superlatives in front of my name than Steamboat did, so, you know.
Well, you're in our studio.
We missed friend to furry woodland creatures.
Okay. You're in our studio along with Kevin Sullivan, who began his career in the 70s and has wrestled all over the world, famous for his signature move, the Devil Stomp. He is now a head booker for World Championship Wrestling, the depraved leader of the Army of Darkness in championship wrestling. The devil made him do it. The Prince of Darkness, Kevin Sullivan. You look like a teddy bear over there.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, especially with a guy that I consider one, if not the smartest guys left in the business, and the top one to three managers of all time.
One to three? Yeah. Somewhere in there in one to three.
Yeah, you're one to three, because after you, it starts.
And by the way, also after the Prince of Darkness and leader of the Devil's Army and et cetera, you forgot to mention Kevin is also a former altar boy.
It's a yin and yang. You can't have good without evil.
That's true. You got to have them both. Otherwise, you got nothing to fight against. Now, I understand. I heard this nasty rumor that this Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest, which starts today, that this is the last one. Is that true?
That is true.
Why?
We're trying to twist Greg Price's arm to do more. But, you know, this is the 10th anniversary. It's been an annual event here at the Charlotte Hilton University Place for the past 10 years. But it's just a tremendous effort, undertaking to put on this thing, and also they're not making any new legends, unfortunately. So Greg decided to go out with a bang this year.
It's still going on. It's still all over TV.
No,
why not?
No. It's not. And Jimmy hit it right. First of all, Greg does a wonderful job.
Yeah.
But when Jimmy said they're not making legends anymore, I thought about this before. In the 50s and 60s, there wasn't guys that were huge stars still making money off of wrestling because new stars had been created.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to Ricky's talk. Mm-hmm. He's very intelligent, but he left a few things out, okay? and I don't mean that to disrespect him. Here's the thing.
Yeah.
First time I came to Charlotte, there wasn't liquor by the drink. First time I came to Charlotte, there was no sports teams. First time I wrestled in Florida, there was no sports teams in Florida. Now they have 3 football teams, 2 hockey teams, 2 basketball teams. We were the only sport. We were the only
game in town.
Only game in town. If you didn't go see wrestling, you didn't go out to entertainment. And then now everybody's going to say, well, the Northeast. Well, baseball didn't go west of the Mississippi. Most teams were, there was the Boston Red Sox, mm-hmm. Boston Braves, New York Yankees, New York Giants, Brooklyn Dodgers, Philadelphia Athletics, Philadelphia Phillies, St. Louis Browns, St. Louis Cardinals, Chicago Cubs, Chicago White Sox.
That was it.
And Detroit and, you know, a few other places. Cleveland and Cincinnati, but there wasn't that much, and television wasn't exposed to baseball till a lot longer than wrestling was. Wrestling was the first thing ever exposed on television.
Yeah, people don't in Charlotte, for instance, WBTV, in the studio where they now do the nightly news.
I was just there yesterday.
That's where wrestling was, in that room.
You know, and that's the thing.
And if you look up above the light grid, you can still see the windows where people would sit above the rink. Or the ring, rather, and look down on the action.
Would I say they're not making any new legends? And I say that, you know, kind of mockingly. But also, as Kevin said, it's harder to make a legend these days. And in professional wrestling, wrestling was so popular in the Carolinas because of stations like WBTV broadcasting. It was on your local broadcast affiliate in the days before there were 400 channels on cable. And the Charlotte Coliseum had live matches every month. The old Coliseum. Well, now both of them are the old Coliseum. the Independence Arena used to be the old Coliseum. The new Coliseum is now the old Coliseum.
Actually, it's gone. The new Coliseum is gone.
Okay, it's gone. It's a parking lot now. But the point is, Charlotte loved wrestling and North Carolina loved wrestling. And in my book, I figured out in 1986, just between Charlotte and Greensboro, there were well over 300,000 paid admissions to wrestling just in the course of that year in just those two cities. In North Carolina, as a total, it was like a million.
I mean, Ricky ended his conversation with us, and he couldn't be here today because he's in the air right now flying to Charlotte, so we recorded it.
And boy, are his arms tired.
Yeah, but because he's a heavyweight. Yeah. But he ended it by saying he likes to thank the fans because the fans gave him everything. But, you know, there's something when you're talking about how popular it was popular because it really connected with people.
Oh, yeah.
Explain that, because, I mean, people, I remember when I first moved here, people, that's all they talked about.
Well, you know, that's the thing is that, and especially for Charlotte, and that's why that the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest annually has been such a destination point for so many people. Hundreds of people make it their summer vacation because it's their childhood. They grew up with those stars and those memories, and it made the connection because you had live television on all the major broadcast stations in the markets in the Carolinas. You had regular events, whether it be in Greenville every Monday night or whether it be in Charlotte or Greensboro or all over the state, Fayetteville, Raleigh, etc. It was a social event for people to go out live to the matches every week or every month and see their same friends and watch these guys, and they were larger-than-life personalities.
Yes, there were great characters, and there was storytelling going on.
Well, I break it down to two simple facts.
Okay.
The good guys, the girls wanted to date them. The bad guys, the guys were afraid of them.
That's true.
It breaks down to that simple. You're either afraid. I'll tell you a story. I wrestled when I was 10 years old.
Really?
I was, amateur wrestling.
Okay.
I was state champion four different weight classes. I was New England champion once. I knew wrestling wasn't real when I was 10 years old.
You're the first person I've ever known in wrestling to say that wrestling wasn't real. You're the first one.
I knew it was.
Well, it's become in vogue the last several years. Yeah. We didn't used to do that.
Yeah. But I went to the wrestling matches and I saw the original Sheik wrestle. The building actually moved. And I said to myself, I don't care if the rest of those guys aren't real. That guy's real. And I always say this. People go like they go to a movie, willing suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, they go because they're 11-year-old kids right before Christmas, and this is the last Christmas they're going to have where they believe in Santa Claus. And if you can give them a guy that gives them Santa Claus, you'll keep drawing money.
Yeah.
In today's day and age, because there's so much television, it is hard to keep the guys' names and people, Jimmy's.
And there's no local connection anymore, also. There's no, it's a national product. It's like watching Holiday on Ice in a wrestling ring, or you go to see the Harlem Globetrotters. Who's on the team? Metal Arc Lemon's retired. We're not sure, but hey, it's the Globetrotters.
Right.
Before it was names on the marquee, the main event guys, and for Kevin, it was the Sheik. For the guys here in the Carolinas or the fans here, it was Johnny Valentine.
You know, it's gone
who they believed in.
It's gone that way in almost every business in the world now, and particularly in show business, where, like, like on Broadway. There used to be stars in these Broadway shows. Not anymore. They're machines. They're machines that where the people, the component parts are replaceable. It's the overall effect that people go to see. And the same thing's happening here, right?
That's what's hampered the Legends Fan Fest, because when I say they're not making any new Legends, they make a lot of stars, but they don't make as many Legends as they used to because there's not that opportunity.
Kevin.
The other thing is, there are points in people's careers that people can point back to, and it becomes a legendary match, and it expands upon and expands upon the Jimmy Cornette first-time scaffold match. I mean, people talk about that all the time. I happened to work for Jimmy one time in Smoky Mountain Wrestling when he ran Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which I think could be still run today, where I stuck a spike in a guy's arm and it looked real, and people still talk about that. There are things like that. But nowadays, and you hit it on the head, you know how you said there's no stars? We're about a year and a half from everything being graphic. We will have movie stars that are going to be graphics.
They don't hold you up for contract renegotiation.
No, they talked about this. They talked about this yesterday on NPR.
Okay, yeah. And the other thing is, we're heading that way because if you watch a movie, what's more exciting, the movie or the graphic game? You blow up everything in the graphic game, and it doesn't cost you a whole lot of money to blow it up in a graphic game. If you're on a set and you're blowing up a B-57, it's costing you a lot of money.
Well, now, knowing this, you could bring the Prince of Darkness back as a graphic game and make some money off of it, Kevin.
You know, when I was a kid, as long as you had, like, a ball and a stick, you were happy. You know, and now, it's you know, the games the kids play are more work than I used to work when I worked.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just the wrestlers. It was the managers who are also characters, too. And you were a manager. You started as a legitimate fan. And your story, the story of your journey to where you are today from where you began, is really fascinating. And we only have 30 seconds left in this segment.
And the rest is history.
No. I think we'll come back and let you tell that story.
Very good.
Because you started as a kid.
Yes.
And there was a story built around you as a kid which made people like or hate you, and really like or hate your mother.
Yes.
Your real mother.
Yes.
All right,
Mama Cornette.
We're going to come back and talk about all that with Jim Cornette and Kevin Sullivan in advance of the Fan Day, Fan Fest that's going on at the University Hilton. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Boatsman Gilmore Wagner, offering accounting, tax, and financial advisory services for local businesses with offices in the Charlotte and Huntersville Lake Norman areas. BoatsmanGilmoreWagner.com. Since March, the Ebola virus has killed nearly 700 people in four African countries, the worst outbreak in history. And on the Diane Rehm Show, they talk about understanding the nature of this virus and the fight to stop its thread. That's coming up on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to talk wrestling in advance of the Fan Fest weekend, now's your chance. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, Facebook or Twitter will also get you to us, and we are coming right back.
Hi, this is David Green. Now, many of you know my voice really well. Some of you probably wake up to me. I mean, who knew that one of the perks of this job was all this pillow talk? Well, since you and I are close, I'm going to make a bold suggestion. When it's time to unload your current car, instead of trading it in, why don't you donate it to this station? Believe it or not, we can turn it into Morning Edition, All Things Considered, or Radiolab. It's easy. Here's how.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Kevin Sullivan, former professional wrestler, Prince of Darkness, and Jim Cornette, professional wrestling manager, the Louisville Slugger, carried that tennis racket all around. But your career began really, you started as a fan.
Yes.
You loved this, and you were a kid.
I was a kid in Louisville, Kentucky, and I found wrestling on television when I was 9 years old and started watching regularly and finally was able to talk my mother into taking me downtown Louisville in 1974 when I was 12 years old. Was you know, it was like, oh, you don't go downtown at night, Jimmy, you know, had things happen. But she, I finally got her talked into taking me to the matches one night when there was a battle royal, and I'd always wanted to see one of those. And she found out nobody was getting mugged in the parking lot of the Louisville Gardens, and there was thousands of people there, and it was lit up and everything. So we went to the matches every Tuesday night. And I started taking pictures when we got a front row seat. I got a 35-millimeter camera for my 14th birthday and started taking some pictures. And they came to the attention. We already knew the promoter was a lady named Christine Jarrett, whose son was Jerry Jarrett, one of the top wrestlers and also behind the scenes was the matchmaker. And her grandson is Jeff Jarrett, who worked for TNA Wrestling and has been a big WWE star since then. But she was the local promoter there. And she knew me as the kid that came and bought all the pictures at the merchandise stand and all the programs and did one of everything. Give me one of everything. It was like 50 cents a piece at the time. And so she saw my pictures and said, well, those would sell on the merchandise stand. And I was 14 years old then. And 6 years later, I was the official photographer at ringside, took all the merchandise photos, wrote and published my own magazines that they sold at the arenas, wrote all the programs, was a fill-in ring announcer, was doing photography for the wrestling magazines that were sold on the newsstands around the country, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, also Gong Magazine in Japan. And so finally, when I was 20 years old, Jerry Jarrett came and sat down and said, would you like to be a manager? Oh, I never thought I would get the opportunity to do something as a performer actually involved in wrestling. And I said, oh, yes. And the idea that he had was something that Playboy Gary Hart had done when he was much younger. Gary came before me. I would have a rich mother. Mm-hmm. That would buy my way into wrestling. I would come from a rich family, and that I would be this milksop, you know, little putz kid that didn't know what he was doing and clueless. And mommy,
yes, and
had bought him everything.
I've seen some pictures of that era.
Yes,
and I looked the part.
I looked the part. Yes, and yes. I played the part very well. And the reason for that was simply because since I had started around the matches so young, I didn't have a driver's license. My mother had to take me to the matches to my job when I was doing the photography and the ring announcing, et cetera. You know, I couldn't
drive. So people knew your mom.
So
they associated her with you.
And for all those years of going to the matches on Tuesday nights, and then she would help at the merchandise stand, and she was friends with Miss Christine. And so then finally, when Jerry came up with this idea and said, boy, they're really gonna hate you for this. Because everybody hates the rich kid that don't have to work for anything, right? But the places like in Memphis and the places that my mother had not gone to the matches, they disliked me. But the places that my mother had gone to the matches and they knew her, they hated me because they were like, your mother's such a wonderful woman. How could you have turned out like this? You no good so-and-so. And now I got a ton of heat for that.
I got to ask you, since your mom was reluctant to take you to downtown Louisville in the beginning.
Yes.
Now she's become the rich mother of this brat kid.
Yes.
And the fans don't like her either in some places.
She loved it, though.
Okay.
She loved because she had been around the business at that point long enough. She knew everybody. She'd got to know how things worked, and she got a kick out of it. Of course, she stayed away from the matches at that point afterwards. She stayed home. But to this day, Mama Cornette remains the most famous pro wrestling personality that was never seen in public, never appeared on a show, never did a pre-tape, never did an interview on television, was just talked of and never, not even a picture, was never seen. But Mama Cornette to this day is legendary.
This is why this sport was so much fun. But you're letting this in on behind the scenes. There were a lot of people who bought this hook, line, and sinker.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I figured out at one point during my career managing the Midnight Express, I had 100 people go to jail willingly to take a swing at me in front of a police officer and many times connected. But over 100 went to jail for at least the night or at least a little while just to get a shot at me.
Well, the thing that's left out is we bought into the personality. The personality from that you see that was successful was not much different than the person himself. I've always said this about Jimmy Cornette. By the way, he still owes me $14 for pictures he was selling off buying out of the back of the
car. Oh, I forgot to bring that.
But anyway, I would see Jimmy, and I'd been in the business 10 years, I would see Jimmy around ringside, and he would position himself to take a picture before it was going to happen. Uh-huh. And I said, this kid's got it. He knows what it's coming up. Like, there's been thousands of pictures been lost, right? The famous Ali one, you know, was Lewiston. Lucky shot.
Right.
Jimmy's weren't lucky. He knew he could anticipate what was going to happen. So if he was on the left side of the ring, he would go to the right side of the ring because he knew the guy was going to come off the top and miss, and he was going to get that expression.
He knew the choreography. Yeah.
The other thing that Jimmy had, most managers want to take away from their steeds, whether it be a single or a tag team. Jimmy Cornette added so much because Jimmy didn't always do something. He may go a couple of nights with just a verbal conversation, with confrontation with people. He didn't hit them all with rackets.
Not always.
Not the wrestlers. He didn't hit the wrestlers with the rackets. So the people would get lulled into sleep thinking, well, the rock and roll, this time they got Haystack Calhoun as a referee. They're in a cage. They lit it on fire, and they're going to shoot Jimmy's mother if he wins, right? Jimmy would hit them with the racket, and they'd lose. And they'd say, oh, he's so obnoxious. That rich kid is so obnoxious.
Now, Kevin won a few popularity contests also, though.
Well, yeah, let's talk about
as a matter of fact, didn't the fans in Florida once burn down your car?
They burnt down the people that were cheering for me.
Oh, that's right. He had some fans in Florida. The other fans burnt down his fans' car because they were so mad.
You began your career, Kevin, in the 70s. You wrestled all over the world. You started as what they call a face, a baby face, a good guy in the 70s. And in the 80s, you adopted this devil-worshipping persona. Why?
I never took the word devil-worshipping.
Okay. Right.
I never
used
that.
Army of Darkness, Prince of Darkness.
I never used that.
Okay.
Okay, that came out of a magazine, Bill Apter, and he won't admit to it.
Or retract it.
It cost me a job here. Jerry Falwell got on TV and said it was too dark. I lost my job here about it.
He can't take a joke?
Yeah, but it's basically from Shakespeare to Odysseus to any of them. It's good versus evil. It's a Greek tragedy.
Right.
Eventually, if you do it right, you get so much, which we call heat, the baby face, to become a knight, you can't slay a salamander. You have to slay a fire-breathing dragon. So eventually they get to slay the fire-breathing dragon. But my thing that I did came because, you know, Jimmy's a smart guy, and he made his gimmick work for himself. I was sitting at home one night, and I was watching interviews on MTV. And back then, they were kind of dark, you know, Thriller, Billy Idol.
Mm-hmm.
I started to see, and then the horror movies were coming out, and I kept on seeing what it was going on. And then the 80s in Florida, there would be a Miami if there wasn't speedboats, if you get my drift. I started putting dark circles under my eyes, and I was a good guy. And there was a controversy. Some of the good guys said, this is not the guy he used to be when I came back to Florida. And I had two factions saying, yeah, he is. No, he's not. So I would start to put stuff under my eyes, and I'd be talking in a regular interview and say, oh, by the way, I saw that LTD follow me. So right away, the paranoia, it wasn't hard for people to start relating.
Uh-huh.
And I had great I had giants to work with. I worked with Andre. I worked with Blackjack Mulligan. I worked with Dusty Rhodes. I worked with everybody that was a foot and a half taller than me. You know? And they sold for me, so the people thought I had this unusual power or I was a madman or whatever. But it goes back to you have to, in my opinion, to draw money, and I think Jimmy will agree, you either have to attempt a violent, horrible act and be stopped, or you have to do a violent act.
Yeah. Let's talk about this, because this is very creative. I mean, this is theatrical. It is movie-making at its best. I mean, it's characters, it's storyline, it's developing things over the course of time.
I've always thought it's an American art form. It's performance art. It's live as it happens. Yeah. A lot of people think that wrestling is scripted, and, well, they went against the script. You can't lay out, although some guys these days try to, you can't lay out a 20-minute match move for move. And the best interviews where the wrestlers are allowed to speak on television are not scripted. They come from the heart. If you tell a joke, you might tell the setup of the joke a different way every time, but the punchline is always the same.
Yeah.
And with Kevin and myself and the people who came in our era in wrestling, it was up to us. They would say, "You're wrestling so-and-so, and you're in Charlotte, and you've got 3 minutes. Go out and sell me some tickets."
Yep.
And we would have to create that. Now that it's written for people and they're expected to perform things, it's so much more tightly controlled.
Well, not only that, back in those days, you would go from Greensboro to Charlotte to Raleigh to Greenville, South Carolina. It was kind of like vaudeville in that you could do the same act night after night after night.
And nobody ever knew.
That's
because
right.
It was a different place.
But when you do it on television, it's one and
it's
done.
It's one and done.
And the other thing was, we weren't under contract, so we had to draw money. I had to feed my family. So if the house dropped and I was on top, not only did I get heat at home, I got heat with the guys.
But you know, also,
I didn't draw the money.
But not only is it strategy and entertainment and building a storyline and creating characters and being creative throughout your entire career to develop these things over time, it is athleticism. And you developed some signature moves: the diving knee drop, the fireball, the golden spike, the shoulder breaker, the tree of woe.
Yeah.
That was a deadly one, the tree of woe.
The tree of woe came from Arnold Schwarzenegger and Conan. That was that horrible looking tree.
Uh-huh.
So I decided, hang a guy up one time, and I ran from one end to the corner to the other end of the corner with a knee, and he didn't die. And I said, "Well, I think I can do this." So I kept on trying it. But God rest his soul, Gordon Solie was one of the greatest announcers of all times, because Gordon sold wrestling like it was a sport.
Yeah.
And there was an invisible wall. I could, as maniacal as I was, I would never put my hand on Gordon, because Gordon was the Pope. You couldn't do that. But I would also use Gordon as a ploy, and he would fall into it. It was like, who's on first? I'd sit down. My whole thing was that I had been to Asia, that I had been to Ipoh, Malaysia, and I have been. I walked the temples. I've been there. I've been to the cave temples in Ipoh, Malaysia, 2,500 years before Christ. I've been to the colorful festival in India where they throw the colors. I've been all the places. So I would say to Gordon, when he was really getting to me, and the people say, he's going to have to take it, I'd say, "Oh, by the way, I stopped by Samoa and Princess Ananga told me to tell you hello." He go, "We don't have time to talk about personal things now." And I said, "Well, there's milk being missed." And, stop that now. Let's get on to something now. Gordon sold it like it was a legitimate sport, like Jimmy had just stolen the football, that I had just gotten away with the worst tackle. He played it up. And Bob Caudle was another guy from here.
Bob was a great announcer.
Bob was a great announcer. This was not Jimmy's work, not my work, not Dusty's work. this was a team effort, and it started with the announcers, the referees. It was a play, like you said.
Yeah.
It's, you know, in the Greek chorus, that's what it was. The Greek chorus was behind you, and you performed. And if you were lucky enough to pull it off, you know, you got another week on top.
Well, this is a revelatory conversation because, as I said, I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that this wasn't a sport and that it wasn't real. And I'm curious. I know that you guys are admitting this, and obviously
now here's the thing. Yeah. If this
what's the fans' reaction to that now?
If this was 20 years ago and this was a witness stand in open court, we would lie like rugs. But now with the internet, and that's one thing. A lot of people think that professional wrestling is more popular now than it has been in the uh-huh. past because they see it on national television right. every Monday night. The right. problem is, it's one program on Monday night where there used to be 25 different regional programs with the loss of Crockett Promotions, the loss of so many other territories. That's what makes it tougher for guys to break in these days and achieve the heights that we have already achieved.
And the last thing is...
And nobody believes anything anymore because of the internet. That's where I was going.
The last thing I'll end with this is I've broken my neck. My shoulders right. only go this high.
So it is real to that degree.
It's real.
Absolutely.
If you do it right, it hurts. If you do it wrong, it hurts you.
Jim Cornette and Kevin Sullivan, you can meet them today and through the weekend and have as much more fun than I had because you can actually have a conversation with them that goes longer than 40 minutes. The Wrestling Fan Fest at the University Hilton through the weekend. It begins this morning. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Unlimited Possibilities Family Care Home, providing Alzheimer's and dementia care in a home-like environment.